Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And here I am, Peter Bregan, with, as always, a lovely guest, a caring, sensitive, interesting man, and an academician, all in one marvelous package, whom I'll introduce you to more formally in a few minutes. Have you heard the fabulous news, at least as being touted as great news? GSK and GlaxoSmithKline, one of the largest corporations in the world, multi-billion dollar income a year, revenues a year, they have announced that they're no longer going to pay doctors to go sell drugs to other doctors, and they're no longer going to pay their reps on the basis of how many prescriptions are being sold, I guess, in their sector, in their sales area. Wow, this is all very exciting, isn't it? Now, what could motivate GSK to make a PR gesture at this time? Or is this just getting the truth and seeing after all these years that buying their way through the medical profession like a scythe through wheat is not really the best way to go about it? Well, what could motivate them? Well, they've already broken the record for civil and criminal fines that they've agreed to with the Justice Department at $3 billion. China is all over them, and of course, China's not as nice as we are. Probably doesn't love drug companies as much as we do. China's after them for buying doctors, one of the very things they're claiming now they're going to let go of. And there's a lot of deceitfulness, according to and manipulation, according to what China's complaining about. Now, I have to confess to having a lot of professional knowledge, unusual amount, about GSK, because there have been a lot of malpractice suits against them. I mean, pardon me, product liability suits against them, and I've been involved in a number of them. Other docs have been involved in suits against them, too. And if you want to find out the kind of stuff that actually goes on in GSK that they've, as far as I know, not promised to never do again, you can go on my website, and I've written three articles based on a product liability report that I did about the company, where I went through their files and actually evaluated how they were marketing and developing Paxil, paroxetine, probably the most dangerous of the antidepressants. And usually product liability reports such as mine, it's, I don't know, dozens of pages and dozens more of appendices, they don't get made public because the drug company settles it as it had done in the case involving this product liability report. They settle, and no one ever hears about it. But I was involved in yet another case involving Paxil against the drug company, and the drug company said to the judge, well, Bregan doesn't have any data, whereupon the attorney said, oh, yes, he does, Your Honor. Well, he's got this report that the company hasn't allowed out, and gave the report to the judge, and the judge let it become public. So based on that, I was able to write three peer-reviewed articles that you can find on my website about Paxil and the kinds of things the drug company did. For example, it hid data on suicidality and suicide. It would take a suicide case and recode it as very mild kinds of problems, such as emotional ups and downs, things like that. And it would include suicides in their placebo group, you know, which tilts it. If you got these events happening in placebo, then they just don't have anything to do with the drug. So they put into the placebo group suicide attempts that shouldn't have been in the placebo group. In fact, the FDA, years after a major disclosure, got around to criticizing them for this. And they did things like not allowed their investigators to code for akathisia, which is a very common, horrendous adverse effect of inner agitation. It's like torture that drives people to psychosis and suicide. So they just didn't have the American trials code for akathisia, which I was later to show through the European trials was indeed related to suicides and suicide attempts. So we're talking about such a web of deception and distortion that I think we have to look on this new announcements by GSK as their determination that it just wasn't worth doing these things anymore. And besides, China's going after them, and who knows, maybe the Justice Department would go after them again, and they were just brimming full with legal assaults on them. Well, so much for the latest in the news. My guest is Miles Groff. Miles, are you there?
Hi, Peter. I am here.
Oh, well, good. You got to hear my spirited introduction.
Yes, indeed. I'm listening closely.
Well, Miles Groff is really a lovely man. I'll give you a little bit about his background. He's trained as a psychoanalyst in New York, and he's been in private practice since the 70s. And, Miles, people can come see you. They can phone you and become your patient if they want.
Yes, that is a possibility.
Are you listed in the phone book in New York?
Yes, that's easy to find me. I can direct you by way of a college site, or I can give you a telephone number, or however you want to do that, I can certainly do that, yes.
All right, well, we can get to that later, but folks can actually just look you up, can't they? Miles Groff, G-R-O-T-H, Ph.D., he can give you his website later on. He's trained as a psychoanalyst, as I mentioned, but he's just not got that usual stiff stuffiness I associate with people trained way back in analysis. He's a mensch. He's the author of four books. He contributes regularly in a blog on Psychology Today, which is, I think, a really great positioning, and it's called Boys to Men. Dr. Groff is really a leader in promoting the idea, developing the idea of an existentially oriented psychotherapy rather than drugs and CBT and the stuff that gets pushed nowadays. He's been teaching for two decades at Wagner College, and he recently there hosted a symposium on R.D. Lang, and he invited me to present and gave me a really nice position in the order of presentations at the conference. And I've talked about that on my show a few times. And that's where I met him. We happened to have a lunch together, and I just really thought that this is a man that you should get to know. In 2010, he published a book, Engaging College Men, Discovering What Works and Why. And it's a collection of studies of 10 colleges and universities that have formed centers for boys and men. By the way, you could contrast that with probably every college and university in America, with a few exceptions, already has a center for women, but the vast majority not for boys and men, a subject we'll discuss. So he's active in promoting. He's an activist. He does things. He's promoting the formation of such centers throughout the world. With that, hello, Miles. I'm so glad to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that we had an opportunity to meet back in October. I had known your name and followed your work for many, many years. And so it was a wonderful opportunity to to interact on a couple of different fronts.
Well, where would you like to start?
Well, I guess the most important thing is for me is college age male population. And when we talked briefly about how to take the discussion, I said that the reason this age group is so important to me is because it's, for me, the bridge group between boyhood and, let's say, fully mature manhood in this country and in all developed countries. And it's a particularly vulnerable age group at this time in history because of certain developments in academe. And so if things go well in the formation of these kinds of centers and what they do, I can see that graduates of schools will, when their fathers bring some of this, view back to their own sons and daughters, and go forward as they take their place in society as a different kind of man than perhaps we've seen come out of the college scene in the last 20 or 30 years. So for me, I suppose the starting point is, you know, the question, why college men? And I would say that the reason for the importance of focusing on this age group is their pivotal stance between boyhood and the rest of manhood.
Hey, Miles, you've been seeing changes in this boy-to-men transition over the years, and it's gotten you quite concerned. Am I right about that?
Yes. it started... I've been in the classroom since the 70s and a clinician since the end of the 70s, and in liberal arts colleges, actually. And I saw... I've seen over the last 40 years some changes in the behavior and the comportment, the ways of expressing themselves, and then finally changes in the numbers of young males in my classrooms and in the consulting room as well. What I began to notice, and it really struck home perhaps for the first time strongly about 15 years ago, was a reticence and a kind of quiet, a stillness that was unusual compared to what I experienced in the early years of teaching and thinking about my own behavior and the behavior of my peers. And I wondered why these guys had gone silent and why they were less engaged, involved in the classroom, seemed less interested in what they were reading, what they were doing. And then even more recently, there were just fewer of them. So I attended to that around, checked with some admissions personnel that I know at a number of schools, including Wagner, where I teach, and they were able to confirm for me that, in fact, in absolute terms, the numbers of young males were shrinking. And no one has an answer right now. There'll probably be many answers, but no one has a clear answer as just why that trend has occurred. It is certainly a trend that has been confirmed.
So Miles, it strikes me that this is amazing that this is occurring at a time of economic changes which require men and women to have more education in order to compete. So are we looking at an increasingly large group of men who are not educated to meet modern economic requirements for work?
Without a doubt. The claims that I've been making and other people have been making is, well, guys are smart and they realize that there are no jobs out there anyway, and why that require a degree, so why do that? That's fallacious. As a matter of fact, the kinds of jobs that they would go to, let's say, trades and factory work and that sort of thing, have diminished. Blue collar work has diminished. That would have ordinarily taken young men without a college degree or more.
Miles, is this like a decline in assertiveness or in masculinity or promoting oneself or the pursuit of self-interest? Inhibition on these people, these youngsters?
As I describe this reticence and having gone silence, there are a number of reasons to explain this, I think, and probably the one that's most shocking, or should be most shocking to your listeners and to all of us, is that lots of, and I'm talking about samples from Australia, Canada, and the States, lots of guys are reporting that they don't feel welcome on university college campuses. Imagine you're going into a public or a large organizational setting such as a college or a university, and walking around, going in and out of public spaces and private spaces, and having the sense that people wish that you weren't there. Now, that's a pretty awful feeling, and I don't mean to say that this is the case with all young men, but it is the case with a significant majority of them, and we have to wonder why this is occurring. And this is, I believe, what has driven them into silence and caused them to be less outspoken. And by the way, the fellows who do not have degrees are not going to be men who will be chosen for spouses by women who do have degrees, and more women do have degrees, which is all for the good. But that's another feature here that we have to look at. Who will want to get into a long-term relationship, particularly if there will be children, a close relationship, a family over many, many years, if the husband is not able to do what the wife can do, what both partners must be able to do in this kind of this time and economy. So there are a multitude of factors here, psychological, sociological, economic, that are all converging on this very, very
Miles, young men say they don't feel welcome, is it by other men, by women, by professors of both sexes? Who are they feeling unwelcome by? Can they pinpoint it?
I think that the general ambience of the place, which is set by academic affairs, student affairs, sets the tone. But I think that it's also found in many classrooms. And this is particularly disturbing to me as someone who was keen to welcome the many, many women who were entering higher education in the 70s when I was a young teacher. So I would say that this feeling of not being welcome is generalized by way of certain requirements during orientation, and it may also be appearing in the content and in the kinds of responses that the students get in certain classes with certain professors. I think that the girls and the boys themselves don't have a problem with the boys on campus. And by the way, I use girl and boy here because that's what they call themselves. They don't call themselves men and women.
Okay.
You know, but no, they're female counterparts and their male counterparts welcome them, and girls want to date them, and they're welcome certainly by their peers. But it's something about the university environment that has changed, and in certain classrooms that we, I believe, will find to be one of the reasons that that the guys are feeling somewhat marginalized and wish they weren't.
And Miles, this is. Miles, this is profoundly sure. important. I've never heard this analysis before. It reminds me of something I think you and I would probably agree on, that this is a process that I have seen, because I haven't thought about it so much in regard to college. I have seen throughout, primary and secondary education, where a boy who behaves like the boy I was, and that most boys were, is now seen as having a mental disorder, at the least ADHD, and maybe a lot more, and is drugged and doesn't get the time to play and can't roughhouse on the playground. So is this a continuum from kindergarten on through, and you're looking at the final manifestation of it?
I take it back to daycare, and some of my students in our senior seminar who worked at the daycare center as volunteers as part of their senior work report that you find these attitudes towards little boys, 2.5, 3, 4-year-old boys as well as in junior high, in elementary school, long before junior high, where, for example, tag is forbidden, where running around is discouraged, where any kind of activity that could be construed as excessive or wild, now who decides what that is? It's usually boys, and as you know, these boys are among a very, very large percentage. I saw the figure just the other day. It's close to 20%, I think, now, of boys who have been diagnosed, of children, and most of whom are boys, who have been identified, diagnosed with ADHD. And most
yeah, that's the high school population of boys.
Yeah.
Around 20%. That's what we're told. It could be worse. And that's just ADHD. What about bipolar disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, and whatever else? Yeah.
Right, from earlier on. Yeah. So I think it's... something that has filtered up. I think if we see this in long historical context, we'll see that these are changes at the college level that began to be implemented back at the primary school, elementary school level decades ago. It's been in the air for a fairly long period of time, and it's only now beginning to show itself. Later and later in boys' lives and young males' lives.
Well, this is incredibly important information. I think one of the things we'll want to look at in the rest of the hour is what you're doing and other people are doing to correct this. I'm sure you discuss it in your book, Engaging College Men, Discovering What Works and Why, and also to look at the various forces that have gone into this. Before going there, how is your work received? I mean, you told me you have one of the few courses in the country on boys and men.
So far as I know, and I'm hoping, I hope I'm wrong, I've not been able to find another course anywhere that the psychology of boys and men that I offer at Wagner and started about 7 or 8 years ago, maybe 9 years ago now. So it's a kind of rare.
That's mind blowing. I'm actually sitting here talking with you about this and having an unusual experience of. of here's a cataclysm the size of which I haven't appreciated, and which I'm sure others mostly haven't, and that we really, really need to do what you're doing, which is to blow the whistle on this. Wow, are you running into opposition to doing
well,
this?
It's interesting that I most of the time am ignored. And I suppose that's better than being attacked. For as many years as I've given the course, and I am one of two men, one retired last year, in our gender studies minor department. I think there are maybe 15 or 16 faculty members. I'm the only one who's a man. And what I have discovered over the years, I joined the department, developed the course, and a couple of other gender studies courses, that I get the silent treatment. And even though I have below my name at my office the Men's Center, which indicates what's there, I guess it's the cold shoulder, Peter, and perhaps some people wish I weren't there, but what I have found is that my students seem to welcome me and don't give me the indication that they wish I weren't there. But if there's a way of saying this, describing this response from faculty, it's been one of, I hope he goes away soon. I've been very lucky, I'd say, in having the support of the highest administration at the college. When I talked about opening a men's center some years ago, I went to the president and asked him whether he thought this was something that he would like to see on campus, and he agreed that he would. And I feel very fortunate that there's that kind of insight at that level. So I feel very good in one way that I've gotten that kind of support. But from my colleagues, I'd have to say people don't eagerly rush into my office and say, "So what's happening next? What are you offering next semester? Who's going to come to speak next semester?" Under the heading of the Men's Center. So that's been the response locally. Places I visited, I can tell you, some stories there, but those, of course, are audiences who are already in agreement with what I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, I think what you're doing is incredibly important. We're going to go to break in a minute. When we come back, some of the things I'd like to address are, what's the cause here? Has it got something to do with feminism? How are we empowering women and simultaneously disempowering men, which I don't believe is a necessity by any means? I think powerful men and women do well by each other and for the culture. The role of the pharmaceutical industry and just finding this huge market for suppressing boys. And I have no idea how you and I will think on this one, whether together or separate, but where fits in the changes in America, the loss of a concept of the founding fathers, our desire to dismantle the notion that this nation was founded by heroic men and women, the loss of that notion of individualism and individual strength. I think that must play a role, and I just think there's probably lots of other things I haven't thought about. I look forward, when we come back, to talking about this, and my guest, Miles Groth, G-R-O-T-H, from Wagner College. Let's go to break. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. Welcome back to my hour with Miles Groth, G-R-O-T-H, a professor at Wagner College on Staten Island, and a man with a private practice in New York City of psychotherapy with an existential orientation. Folks, you know, outside of, you know, some of the shows I've done that are just, you know, dead on the issues that my life's been devoted to, which is psychiatric reform, I think this is one of the most important shows ever, and certainly one of the most important issues that our country is facing. And, of course, it dovetails with the psychiatric issues, but it's a thing unto itself. By chance, last week's show with Enrico Nolatti, you can get it on the archives, like you can get this show on the archives. This will go on this evening. The show from last week is last Wednesday is already on. The second half of that show, not the first half, the second half of that show is filled with information documenting statistically and in other ways exactly what Miles Groth is talking about today. So we have two shows in a row by chance on that, but it's the second half of my show last week. Miles, I hope you're there.
Oh, yes, I am.
Would you, where would you like to go? I've given you some suggestions on what I want to talk about. Do you have a particular direction now that I've been talking?
Well, when you outlined what we might chat about in the second half, you mentioned some very general features of culture, and you happened to use the phrase founding fathers. I jotted down a few notes, and you mentioned a few other things, but I jotted down a few notes around that word father. One of the central features of this problem that we've been chatting about here, and I've been thinking about for some years now, is the place of the father. And I think that when we write the history books and look back in an analysis of what's happened in the last 40 years, roughly speaking, we're going to find that a key element of this whole phenomenon, and something that's going to help us explain what went wrong and how things happened as they did, was the changing status of the father. I was very much influenced, still am, by a book by a Jungian psychologist, psychoanalyst by the name of Luigi Zozak, whom I met here in New York a couple of years ago, who published a book 15, 16 years ago. It was translated into English called The Father. And in it, he traces the history of the father and the changes in the status of the father since the Industrial Revolution, and more to the point, during the last century, since the turn of the 20th century, roughly the last 125 years, let's say. And he points directly to the disappearance of the father in so many homes. As you know, the divorce rate in America is 50%. And one out of three boys and girls, one out of three boys is going to be in a family situation without a father. This, I believe, is extremely significant, and it accounts for many of the changes that we talked about in the first half hour that occurred in public education, that occurred recently, more recently in higher education. Boys who don't have fathers are a very different kind of man. I know that some of my feminist colleagues of a certain kind of feminist, would say anybody can be a father. There's a father figure, like a mother figure. You know, a man can be a mother figure, and that's true. But I think that very possible that we could confirm that only a man, a male, can be a father. And this is just one of the unique characteristics of the family, of cultures, all cultures that we know about all over the world, all through history. When the father disappears out of a culture, when families don't have fathers, there are important losses for children, as well, obviously, for the mother of the children, the spouse of the man, but particularly for boys. And I just like to hammer this point home just a little bit more, if I may. I like to say that a mother can raise a boy, but it takes a father to turn a boy into a son. I'm really here borrowing from Zosia's argument, and people can read this in detail if they want to. But in fact, what we might, from a sort of philosophical position here, but it's certainly got psychoanalytic and psychological dimensions as well, what we are seeing in a time where there is the disappearance of the father and the underrating of the father is the disappearance of sons. And a boy who has not become a son is not going to become a man. The implications,
wow,
I think, are pretty stunning, Peter. And the whole picture, to some extent, will have as its focal point the place of the father, the central place of the father, male father figure, and as a male, as a man, in our culture. I had a father. I was lucky to have. I have lots of male students who have grown up with split families or without fathers. You probably grew up in the same kind of situation. It was very rare to not have a father on the scene. And now we're in a culture, though, where that's very, very common. And I think we're going to find out down the road that this has been a mighty disturbance in the culture, and we're already, I think, beginning to see some of the outcomes of that, some of the unhappy results of that. So that's one thing that occurred to me during the break. Perhaps
let me clarify something you were saying. This is all extremely important. You said that a man can be a mother figure. You're not implying that men are more indispensable than women, but rather I hope you're implying that men have a role that is unique and necessary.
Absolutely. I still think women and the natural mother make the best mother figures. But yes, what I was saying was I think that there is here an important role that is unique to the male, particularly for the boy,
the son.
Exactly.
Very, very, very interesting and very well put. Can you give a sense of what you think the difference in the inner experience, the inner psychology of a boy who's never been a son, the fatherless boy? What is that like that you think is different?
Here, I'll just mention Zosia for a moment again.
Spell Zosia for people. Would you spell that name for us?
Z-O-J-A, Luigi Zosia, the father.
Z-O-J-A, thank you.
Z-O-J-A. One of the things that the father does, says Zosia, when he raises the boy above his head and turns him into a son, is says, you're going to be better than I was. You're going to be an improvement over me. You're going to exceed what I've done. You're going to be a better man than I was. Or you're going to be a better person than I was. Well, if that doesn't happen, there's nothing to strive for. Boys do not feel that there's anything to strive for. And so they do not individuate in a Jungian sense to the extent that a boy who feels, wow, I've got something now to do with my life. I've had a challenge set before me. I think that's part of the inner life of boys who have fathers. If those fathers are missing, that will be lacking in their life. There's also well-known empirical evidence that boys who don't have fathers lack the impulse controls that a father clearly brings into the situation of a boy's life. The psychoanalysts knew this, hinted at it, but non-analytic research has shown the same. The boys who show up juvenile halls, who get in trouble, who can't get through the challenges of super impulse appearances in adolescence. The boys who have greater trouble with that typically don't have a father, or have come from a family where there was no father. So I think those are two important elements. There are others, but those are the two that I would cite as pretty central to the psychology of boys who lack a father. I mean, we can certainly say that, you know, the process of identification, that seems pretty obvious. The process of identification is enhanced by the presence of the father. Boys can look to uncles, grandfathers, older brothers, male teachers. But, you know, it's different to have the same old man around for years and years and years and years and years through the time that you're separating from the mother until you reach adolescence and go beyond and leave the father behind. I think it's important to have that kind of continuity. The image is clear. The process of identification is made somewhat easier, and of course it's always difficult. And if I could take two more minutes for one other item.
Sure.
I have a view which is open to some discussion, for sure. But think about this for a minute, and I've thought about it for many years. A boy learns that he's loved from his mother. I think that's one of the major accomplishments of a good mother-son relationship. But I've had it in my head for some time to test this out, that in the interests of identification, for the purposes of identification as a male in the culture, that the boy chooses as his first love object his father. Now, let me be clear about this. You identify with somebody because you love them. You experience being loved. By the way, I think boys return love, other love. I think it's gratitude that they return. We like to think of it as love. I think it's gratitude. But what if it's important to every boy to have this strong affection towards somebody and for the purposes of identifying with this person? I want to be like him. Obviously, I like him. Otherwise, I wouldn't want to be like him. So I would say that the missing father also deprives boys of the opportunity for an experience of initiating strong affectional bond with another human being. And I would go so far as to say that this is the template then for his ways of relating to women in his lives. And eventually, when he passes through the later stages of childhood and early adolescence comes to love his mother as a person and not with all of the implications, you know, of the famous Oedipal triangle. But that would, I think, be in some ways for me one of the findings that I would suggest is
I think it sounds extremely important. When I think new, I like to reflect on my own life, and God knows I wanted to love my father with all my heart. And
yes.
I think that is it's an incredibly important observation and a very interesting idea that it's from that, which I'd never heard before, that it's from that, not from mom's love, but from loving father, that you learn to love in an outward way.
That would be my proposal. Yeah.
Now, what about what's happening in elementary school now? Is there any increase or is it a decrease in men who are teaching in our elementary and, really right through high school? What exposure to men? Is it up or down?
Yeah, well, there are very few males teaching in elementary school, and I know that some educators would like to see that change, and I think it is a very important. It would be a very important remedy to a lot of the problems that are part of the broader cultural situation that we've been talking about. To have more male teachers beginning in the elementary schools. My students mentioned earlier who were in the preschool in the daycare center. We discussed this many times in the seminar, and undoubtedly the boys were drawn to the one or two male aides who were there. They enjoyed the female aides, but there was a special need and a special kind of attachment to the guys who were there. Now, I don't think female teachers are necessarily bad teachers for boys. And here again, we were roughly the same age. And during the time, Peter, when we were in elementary school, we probably saw nearly all of female teachers during elementary school because the men were in the service and things like that were happening. But there's a different kind of woman teaching at the elementary school level now than we experienced in the 50s, I would argue. That being said, I still think it would be important, especially given the circumstances that we've been describing here, to see more men in elementary school. I didn't see my elementary
school. You dropped something in passing. Sometimes you drop these incredible things in passing. How are the women teaching different now?
Yeah, well...
In a sentence or two.
I can only reflect on my own experience, and I have to look at it in this way. My elementary school teachers back in the little town of Greensburg, Pennsylvania, were gender blind. I don't think they saw one gender as being particularly more important than another. In other words, I put the lie to the fact. They thought boys were better than girls. I think they liked us all, and they treated us equally well, and they allowed us to be boys, and they allowed the girls to be girls. I think some of what we were talking about earlier is informing the way some, perhaps many, female teachers now regard boys and girls. And so it's a different kind of attitude towards the person based their gender. It's no longer gender blind, if that makes any sense, in a sentence or two.
Well, and they accepted gender differences. There was a concept of boys will be boys.
Yes.
They were held to a looser standard in regard to impulsivity and activity levels. In many ways, what the pharmaceutical industry has done is to try to enforce on boys, working with psychiatry and education and educational groups, has tried to force on boys our worst ideas about how girls should be, which is, you know, they should be silent and quiet and better withdrawn than causing trouble.
Well, more than one father of young sons that I've known, some, you know, my age, the people I went to college with, have at different times spontaneously said, gee, I just had this discussion with my son's elementary school teacher, and she described this, and he was doing that. And this comment, it's come in different forms, but the gist of it has been, somehow I got the impression she was telling me that, you know, my son was a kind of defective girl and should be somehow different in his behavior. And they were enraged and incensed. And so were the mothers, actually. So when they talked to their wives about these parent conversations, parent-teacher conversations, the mothers were on the same page with the fathers. They didn't think and don't think of their sons as being defective daughters. So I think if you go to real parents out there, and not a lot of what we see in the media, and that has a lot that has been promoted, presented by a certain media orientation, place in the media, most parents don't believe this, and they're going to welcome hearing what we're talking about here, because it confirms their own experience. They know that boys are different than girls, and equity is not equality. Boys are never going to be equal to girls. We're different from females. Equity, that's another matter, of course. Everyone's responsibilities and possibilities need to be equivalent, but we're different. So I would hope.
Well, before we finish, there's an elephant in the room that we need to address briefly, and that is feminism.
Yeah.
You know, I've been in my earlier years almost a student of feminism. I've taught courses that were shocking at the time, decades ago, on the male abuse of women, which was very radical to be doing. I've read widely in feminist literature. I've been profoundly affected by many feminist authors and by women I've worked with, feminist women I've worked with in my reform work, many of whom were the few in the field to stand up on issues like shock treatment and lobotomy. And that continues now. But there is a part of feminism that has diminished men in some level, and I think that's made a contribution. But I also think it's a less a powerful part of feminism today. Your thoughts in that, if you can do it in a minute or two. I think we just need it briefly to address that issue.
Yeah. there are waves of feminism. And obviously, feminism that led to making opportunities available to women was an important kind of feminism. Then there was a sort of ideological feminism, which led to this disapproval of men and proposition such as men are obsolete, men are it's the end of men, men are not needed anymore. Some of the most important feminists, and I would include among them Camille Paglia, have just recently, and in fact you can see this online, her recent debate with three other women, Are Men Gone? Is it the End of Men? There's a certain kind of feminist who is speaking out against that sort of derogatory feminism that gave men, all men, somehow bad name for a period of time. So I'm hopeful that real intersexual dialogue can be restored thanks to these kinds of feminists, as well as to opening up discussion of the kind that we've had today And just asking parents, what do you see with your boys? Does it match what you're supposed to be seeing, given what the media say? So I'm optimistic that with the kind of work that I've been doing and that others are doing, we'll see some breaking of the ice here to see what's really going on and fairly.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm married to Ginger, and she's an extraordinarily powerful woman. And I, when she first came to be with me about 30 years ago, she hadn't read any feminist literature, and I just piled her up with books, Women in Power and other books that were very confrontational on these issues. And she said to me that she thought there was a strain in this that was harmful to women loving men, appreciating men, and wanting men to be empowered just as women. Miles Groff, thank you for being on the show. Do you want to give a phone number? That's up to you, or a website really quickly now.
I would say the best way to contact me would be through at my college email, and about anything we've talked about and about any part of my work in life. How about that?
Yeah, give your email, please, and then we're going to finish.
Yeah, it's M for Miles, MGROTH at wagner.edu. And there's a telephone number there which you can use to reach me. And I'd be happy to hear from any of your listeners and talk to them more. And talk to them.
Ironically, Miles, this is probably one of the most controversial shows I've done. I want to remind people that my previous week, by coincidence, has a very similar analysis being made in the second half. Thank you for your work, which is obviously taking genuine courage and a genuine sense of dedication. I want to have you on again to continue this conversation. Thanks very, very much for being on the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. Thank you so much, Miles.
Thank you, Peter, and I am really delighted that you asked me, and would look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you.